Welcome to the Modern Woodworkers Association, a podcast about woodworking from folk who woodwork. Woodworking is what we do, who we are, and what we like to talk about. So join us as we have a drink, sit around, and talk woodworking.
Hi, and welcome to episode 164 of the Modern Woodworkers Association podcast. I'm Sean Wisniewski of the Corner Workshop, and I'm here with my co-host Diami Plotke of the Penultimate Woodshop. Tonight, we're talking to Gary Rogowski. You may know him from such things as his famed book, The Complete Illustrated Guide to Joinery, or the Northwest Woodworking Studio, or possibly his new book, The Handmade, called Handmade, Creative Focus in the Age of Distraction.
Well, perhaps. Hello, Gary.
Hello.
Hello, hi, guys. Hello, gentlemen.
I have to apologize. I don't have a name for my shop like you guys. I mean,
oh, no, please. You know, my shop was creatively named Corner Workshop because it's in the corner of my basement, and that is the extent of my creativity.
No. And see, Sean, I think you should rename the shop Too Lazy to Insulate My Garage.
You know, maybe. Maybe
this is Mr. R30 talking here, right?
Yeah, 40. Yeah. 40. As my wife literally today was I don't know what she was doing by the fireplace, but we have a fireplace insert that goes into the garage. It's shared, you know, like the back wall of it's in the garage.
Okay.
And she like pulled the, we never use it ever, but she pulled the little screen in front of the logs back and she goes, "It is really cold in here." I said, "Yeah, it's because our basement or our garage is uninsulated. I can't imagine if it was -8 last night, how cold it is in there."
Right.
Cause there's nothing helping it. It's not insulated above or on the walls or anything. There's nothing.
That's so tough.
Yeah. So that wall of the house is chilly.
Chilly.
Chilly. But anyway, enough about the weather.
Yeah.
Well, let's get right into it, Diami. What's going on in the shop?
Bunches. Any avid listener will know that my bench and my table saw and my outfeed table and every bit of my shop is taken up by the four slabs that consist of the shelves for the entertainment center I'm making right now. They are still in that area. Today, I took them all out of the shop, reorganized them so that different ones were on top, and brought them all back in the shop because I am in the throes of pore filling right now. The edge grain of the timber strand that they're made from has lots and lots of little voids and gaps in it. So what I'm doing is coating them with a thickened application of dyed. It's the Total Boat 5-to-1 epoxy system. It seems very similar to the West systems. And after some experimenting, I've figured out that the silica thickener is the best thickener to use in this application. And so I'm mixing them up and I guess kind of like troweling them across the voids. And I've got the edges, which is the rounded over edge, done on all of them. And that needs to be sanded back on 3 of the 4, but it's been applied. And I've got the face. It dawned on me, I only need to do the top surface of these four shelves. So that's half of it. Not that I don't have to do. But the top face of 2 of the shelves, I have put the first coat of epoxy on. And I've not sanded any of it back yet, but it looks like I'm going to need to do a second coat, and hopefully that'll be it, because some of the voids, you can see the epoxy isn't quite flush with the top, but it's pretty darn close.
Are you getting bubbles in the epoxy?
No, I'm not.
Oh, okay. So it's just not filling.
Yeah.
And I've used a heat gun to pull those bubbles out. I don't know if you know about that.
Okay. I have heard about that. But these are, I don't know if you're familiar with timber strand, Gary. It's dimensional lumber made of OSB. It's for high-end framing. So if you think about the little voids that are in the edge of OSB, that's what I've got on the surface of these planks. Because what I did is I took 2x6s, ripped them to 1.5 by 1.5 squares, turned them all 90 degrees, and laminated them back together. So they're essentially edge grain. And the slabs, when they're all done, they're going to get dyed. So I've added the dye to the epoxy, and I'm filling all these pores. So when I'm done, I end up with a smooth surface. Great. And like I said, I have not sanded any of it back yet because with this epoxy, and I don't know if this is how the Total Boats differs from the West, but in looking at it and in playing with them, the Total Boats, the 5-to-1, I've got the book here. The pot life is 25 minutes for the slow hardener. The set time is 10 hours, but the cure time is 1 to 4 days. And that cure time is true whether I use the fast or the slow hardener. Now, I went with the slow hardener figuring the benches are 20 inches wide by 12 foot long. So I wanted to be able to mix big pots and not have them set before I was done applying them. So I figured better slow than fast. Mm-hmm. But overnight, when I did the edges, because Christmas intervened and I had other stuff going on, it was days before I could come back and sand the edges off. And when I sanded the first edge off, it was no problem at all. It was completely hard and dry and it sanded beautifully. When I started to work on a different edge, it was the next day. And that proved not long enough. It was gumming up the sanding pad. It just wasn't working. So I've come to the realization that I need to let them dry the full 4 days. And that's another reason why it's cranking in the shop. Right now, it's 72 degrees in the shop, even though it's in the low teens outside, because I need this epoxy to cure properly. So I'll get tonight when we're done, I'll actually put a coat on the top surface that I'm using as a desk right now. And then tomorrow, I'll drag the top two planks out in the driveway, swap them, bring them back in the garage, and put a coat of epoxy on the last of the four sides that need a first coat of the epoxy. And then that'll be Friday. So maybe over the weekend, I'll monkey with them some more. Maybe not. It'll depend on how the weekend shakes up. But that's what I've been doing in the shop, is continuing to, to work on them. And it's proven to be a very slow process, complicated by the fact that the epoxy takes so long to dry, and that to move from one to the other, I have to drag them out of the shop, rearrange them, and drag them back in. Today, I was racing to get them done as quickly as I could and keeping the garage door closed as much as possible. And it took me 20 minutes to pull all four out, rearrange them, and bring all four back in. And in that time span, the inside temperature of the shop went from 72 down to 66.
Oh, sure.
Yeah. So that's all things being equal.
With a garage door open against?
Exactly. It wasn't.
That's not bad.
It wasn't that bad. But considering that the planks were outside where it was 20 degrees, I brought them in and I haven't yet put any more epoxy on today because I wanted the inside temperature to come back up over 70. And I figured, A, I was going to stink myself out because I'd have this surface that was too tacky to work on and it just smells bad. So if I do it afterwards, now I'm not screwing myself over. So now they're nice and warm and I can work on that.
Not bad. I noticed in some of the images you've been sharing, when I, you know, when we've talked about this epoxy coating for a while, I envisioned it like being completely or mostly blue. Is that not the case where you're going to have a lot of the fibers intermixing with the color? You know, like it's blue in some spots, but it's still that tan, you know, timber strand color.
Well, right now that is how it looks.
Okay.
But that's because I'm using a little plastic, like, squeegee. It's like a fiberglass applicator. It's kind of like a credit card material.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
I'm scraping them in, and I'm not leaving much on the surface.
Mm-hmm.
So when it's all sanded back, it'll be bare timber strand wood fibers with epoxy in the void that should be flush with the timber strand when I'm all done. And then the next step will be to dye the whole thing. Not epoxy, just the normal dyed shellac
just
I use when I dye.
Oh,
so
okay.
This is just the first step. So ultimately, it will all be dyed. But for right now, you're only seeing it in the little pockets and voids.
Okay, that makes sense. It seemed lighter than what I was envisioning in all the times we've talked about it when I first saw it. But yeah, that makes sense.
Yeah.
So the epoxy is not for the... I thought for some reason that the color and epoxy was going to be like the color in total, not just filling and then dyeing over.
It
makes total sense.
Yeah.
No, very, very cool.
And I did one other thing, which I may or may not stick with. I've talked many times about how I use the Festool sanders because of the different platens and the interface pads and the fact that they do curves very well.
Right.
So in sanding back the curved edge, because of the way they're set up and they're just so big, there's nowhere else to set them up. But because of the way they're set up, it was rather high. I had the top plank on edge. And so the top edge of the top plank was a high chest height, a little bit below my neck. and it's 12 foot long, and I'm sanding the curve with my 6-inch ETS 150 sander, which is the 6-inch random orbit sander.
Mm-hmm.
And in that awkward position, going back and forth over this long curve, the weight, it's 4 pounds, it got heavy after a while. And in that weird position, the best place to hold it is the main body, not the handle that sticks out or the grip they have on the top. And the main body gets friggin' hot.
Really?
Oh, yeah. It was uncomfortable to hold. So I pulled out my Festool catalog, and while I have many times poo-pooed their new brushless sanders as nice but an unnecessary upgrade, I bit the bullet and got the 6-inch brushless. The one reason is that it goes from 4 pounds to 2.5 pounds. The way they have the brushless motor, it's much smaller and the grip is entirely differently. So I'm not holding it by the motor anymore.
Well, clearly you should have gotten the Festool mitten that you could wear to protect yourself from the heat from that other.
Well, that's very true. And if it was just the heat, I would have really considered that. But my thought is, I've not had the opportunity to use the brushless one yet. Because I've been waiting for the epoxy to dry. If the brushless one doesn't prove to be an advantage, it's going back.
Right.
And if the brushless one does prove to be an advantage, I think I can get decent money selling my old one, because the Festools are – they're worth more than they should be, quite frankly. But they don't lose their value. So I figured either way, it wasn't the worst investment in the world. So I'm hoping that it actually makes it much easier, because – 4 pounds doesn't sound like much, but it wears you out in that weird position.
Yeah.
Well, sure. Totally understand.
So that's what's going on in my shop.
All right. Well, in my ongoing saga of putting a boy in a new bedroom, he moved in is the day after we got a bed frame, even though it's not done, which I guess is teenage exuberance at its best. So the final base isn't done. The doorway is not painted. The door is not hung. So he's been living for a week now with a bedroom with no door.
I must have shared this story before on the podcast and in all these episodes. But when I was 14, I got a bedroom door for Christmas.
Oh, that's right.
we had been without doors for about 9 months.
That's a major award.
Yeah. That's great.
So yeah, he's still complaining about the kitchen light in the morning, but he's happily sleeping there. But I also, just today, actually, we're on holiday break right now. So, schedules are kind of weird. There's still, he's actually still swimming, my older son. So there's practice every day. So I have a few hours to kill while I'm dropping him off and picking him back up. Mm-hmm. So I actually used my Tormek for the first day today. The one I got, did I get back in October?
Yeah, you got that a while ago.
Yeah, I did. Just trying to figure it out. I trued the stone up a little bit and just tried to take my worst chisel to it just to see. Promising results, although I didn't quite have it totally figured out yet. So I'm eager to do a little more with that. I'm interested to see how it mixes in with my whole sharpening thing, because I know I can't get like the finest cut, edge off of that thing. Yeah. Although close.
What do you normally sharpen with, Sean?
I've got a couple Shapton stones.
Okay.
I also have a granite plate. Is it granite? I don't know. It's stone. But it's a truing plate that I've done sandpaper on.
Did you get the new truing plate?
I did. And that's to tune sharpening stones. So that I have yet to, I got to do a full review on it, but it is a competitor to, I have a Dia Sharp,
okay.
I think, plate, which is it's a steel plate with diamonds encrusted on it, at a pretty coarse grit, but that's to just kind of level off water stones. And I don't have typical water stones. I have those Shapton ceramic on glass stones,
mm-hmm.
and only in two grits. So it's not like I don't get like the highest, crazy polish off my sharpening stuff, but, But yeah, the Tormek was a steal from a buddy, if you remember, and it literally had been sitting underneath my little bench for since I got it. So I just walked by past it today, and I was like, oh, forget it. I pulled an extension cord over to it and hooked it up and filled it with water and just started tooling around with it. And actually, I got the arbor nut is a little loose on it, so when it starts up, it starts unthreading the arbor nut, which is kind of weird, but I got to figure that out.
It's not threaded so that it tightens as it spins. It actually
It's actually a standard thread, and it the rotation of the motor is opposite.
Can you put a little Loctite on that?
Yeah, and what I found out was between the honing wheel and the stone, and I'm sure there's people listening that are going to scream at me for doing something wrong, but you know, being a motor with two drives on it, you can drive them independently. Until you drive them at the same time, they'll tighten up. So I think I've got to work both nuts at the same time to kind of crank it down.
Okay.
Because they'll counteract each other because they're both standard threads on both sides.
Gotcha.
Interestingly enough. So
yeah, you probably need two wrenches to do that.
Yeah. You just kind of get on both sides and get after it. But I noticed that like when it starts up, it slowly spun up in speed a little bit. And then I noticed the nut walking off and then the washer walked itself off and just those two things dunked themselves in the bath. And then I turned off very quickly to make sure that stone didn't go falling because that would have been scary. It weighs a bit, but yeah, I'm looking forward to that. And yeah, that, the new truing stone whose name I totally escapes me at this point, but, I may actually record a full, maybe an audio, maybe a video review of that.
That would be excellent.
That's what my aim is. But anyway, that's about it. Glad the boy's in. Finishing touches yet to come, but that's the brunt
of
it.
Give him a door and call it finished.
No, because here's the problem. And I let the family know in not the friendliest tone. That had this gone to plan, things follow in process. You drywall and then you paint and then you trim and then you install and then you do all these things. Because of the circumstances of we're adding onto a house that's being lived in and this was an extension of a room that was somewhat usable, we want to get this kid inside there, you know, the process of drywalling the new room, but not finishing even the mudding on the common wall with the house was a thing. And then you painted and installed floor and still that mud's not done on the inside of the house.
But so that's not, it's the shared wall, but the house side of the shared wall.
Correct.
Okay.
Yeah. So the room side is painted. It's finished. It's good. And then literally there is flooring. There's an area rug. There's a bed. There's dressers. There's everything already in there. But the doorway, because I'm doing a barn style door, is just a drywalled opening. And even the inside of that is not painted yet.
Do you have to mud the house side before you hang the door?
Yes. Okay. No, well, no, no. So I could cheat, and he wants me to, and I might, hang the door prematurely just to get it in place, knowing that I'll be taking it off to mud and finish and paint at some point.
Could you leave the track, or you'd have to take the whole thing off?
I think I'd have to. I don't know at this point officially how high the track would be. But it may interfere with mudding the joint of the top of the doorway.
Just mudding.
Just depending. Yeah. I mean, I really do want to get a good coat on there before I even start drilling holes for that thing. Just cause like I want to do as much of that as I can. And I'd rather not paint around it or any of that crap. And yeah. But added to that issue is I have a fairly small house and the corner where that wall is in the existing house room, you know, room there, is where we put our Christmas tree. So right now my Christmas tree has a painted wall on its left side and a drywall wall on its right side. If you're looking at the corner.
All right.
So yeah, it made Christmas interesting. And there's like rosin paper taped down in the doorway for when I'm mudding and stuff there. Because I've done like interstitial little bits. I need like a third coat of mud on the inside of the door just to finish off those tiny little pockets of space. Cause I'm not a professional drywaller, and then the outside needs a lot of TLC, but that all got suspended when, he moved in and then Christmas happened. And so tree gets installed and all that stuff. So yeah, that's not very exciting. Gary, how about you?
Yes.
What do you have going on in your shop?
What do I have going on? I just finished up some sawhorses. Got those glued up today. I do this sawhorse design in Home Depot pine and cedar. And they're light as a feather. I love them. I've got about six pair of them now around the shop. I've got some in my kitchen that I just put a slab on top of. And they're just great. And,
what part of the horse is cedar? Just if
I can... The stretcher. So it's it's basically two columns. There's a stretcher down low, and I run this. It's a 2x4, basically, mm-hmm. chunk of cedar, and I run that as a through joint and a wedge through that. And then there's a 1x4 piece of pine on top, set vertically on top. Of the two columns, and they're great. They're light as a feather, and I can load them up with hundreds of pound on top because compression strength is great. Now, and
Gary, with that many sets, do you make them all the same, or do you vary their height or width?
I don't vary their height. This one I dropped an inch because I'm going to put another slab on top. I bought a little place out in the country, and I'm going to put a. It's going to be my interim dining room table until I get around to building a real one. So
okay.
Normally there are 30 inches. And so I dropped this down a little bit because 30 inches with an inch and a half top on it makes you feel like you're at the little kid's table. Mm-hmm. You got your elbows up on top. So normally I leave them all the same height. So they're interchangeable. And the only thing I do is I play around and have different shapes. So I play around with the look of them a little bit, but everything else stays the same.
Okay.
Yeah.
Very cool.
Yeah. And then my resident student and I today, we got some pine out. I said, we're cutting dovetails. And so that's what we did. We just cut a corner joint in some 1x4 pine. And great fun to cut dovetails in that because they squish together. It's great. I'm really good at this.
I had a lot of sins in pine, that's for sure.
The problem with it is you can really squish it together and then split the pine.
Yeah, and then the tail goes sideways. Yeah. But
So that's what I've been working on.
The dovetails are a teaching exercise more than anything?
Yeah, well, he's got a dovetail project coming up. He's got a dovetail box to build. Mm-hmm. And so I wanted him to build a toolbox in pine just to run through it. And he's been adopting a strategy that I'm very familiar with. Perhaps you are as well, where you get to avoid a project, you get real busy with another project. So he's been really busy finishing up a second bench. He had a bench project and he's been really busy on the second bench, which is great. That's just great. And he did a taper sliding dovetail on those for the legs on those. But he's been avoiding the dovetails. So I said, no, come on, come to my bench. We're going to do dovetails together. So we're pushing them along, moving along. It's good.
Nice.
Yeah, it's good.
Now, excellent.
You have one residence? One resident?
Yeah, one full-time resident student. I had two scheduled and then one guy dropped. And then I have a distance program. The distance guys come in next week. So I have seven of them coming next week. And they come in three times a year for basically a four-day workshop. So,
okay.
And they're working on, they're bringing in the projects that they've done back at their shop. And then we're going to start working on dovetails with them as well. So they have a dovetail box with a... butt hinged lid on it and a small table or bench. So those are the projects that they have to build and bring back in the spring. Okay. I choose the project, they do the design work. So I don't There are no restrictions on what the designs can be, but you know, I choose a project so that they're working on some kind of joinery that's important, and get the hang of flow. I think flow is one of the most important and underappreciated things in the shop, because there's so many things that can slow you down.
Oh yeah,
you know, so many things that get in your way. I am going to admit this. This isn't going to go live, is it? I am going to admit this. I had a project once where I had the doors, cabinet is done. It's a really nice design. Like it a lot. Standing cabinet, about 5 feet tall. Two doors on it. Got the door frames made. Cut the panels a half inch short. That was 20 years ago. So, you know, flow is a very important thing. So it won't take much to fix. Just haven't gotten back to it. So I think it's important to keep that in mind with projects as we build them and get in the practice of moving through them and getting to the end.
Right. Now, I asked about the one resident. Is what he does every day, is it just towards essentially his education, or does he also act kind of as an apprentice and whatever you have going on in the shop he assists with? How does it work with him being in the shop all the time?
Well, it's just his education. So it's a very intensive program. So it lasts 9.5 months. And again, he's got a list of projects, both design, what I call design projects and bench projects. So a bench project is making a little pine toolbox. Mm-hmm. But the bench that he made the last couple of weeks was a design project. So I push my students to be working on both design techniques and building techniques. But yeah, I don't want him working on other stuff. He's got so much to do. that this year, I tried it last year. It didn't really work. The distance and local folks in the mastery program in their second year, design and build a chair. And I just don't have, he doesn't have the time. The resident students just don't have the time to do a chair in that 9 months. So that's, there's so much to be done. He's got a full plate.
Okay.
Got a full plate. So, lots to do. Lots of mistakes to make along the way.
So, of course.
That's how it works.
And even if you can cram that into 9 months of learning, what has taken some of us decades to overcome. Well,
yeah, it's a challenge. It's a challenge. But it's he came from a career as a restaurant guy. He used to run restaurants, a wine steward, sommelier, all that stuff, and just needed time at the bench. And that's one of the topics, I think, in the book that that I point out, the need for people to be spending time at the bench. I think it's really important. So it is for Tom this year. So it's good to see.
Pretty good. So, Diami, I know we've got a couple points of interest that have floated our way. You want to take that?
Yes. Well, this is late news to anyone who's paying attention, but Megan has left Pop Wood, and she's off doing, I think she's doing basically freelance copy editing as a full-time gig and a bunch of teaching to flush out her plate. So we absolutely wish Megan the best. We hope to continue our ongoing relationship with Megan. She's always been very, very helpful to us, and we'll do anything we can to help support her. And maybe this is just because everyone I know is gone, but I have to question how this leaves, Pop Wood.
Chris is gone. Megan's gone.
Bob, Glenn, and Chuck are gone.
But they brought on Brendan.
Brendan. So not everyone I know is gone.
So we know one. but no, I'm kind of with you on that. It's a new crew. So I'm curious to see what's in their future. Not that I don't have any faith in them, but it's what we knew was, you know, the stable, you know, cast that we came to know have all gone their separate ways.
Yeah, and I think the nice thing about the woodworking community is that it's just that, it's community. And these were all people who we had the pleasure of meeting and knowing. And I'm sure we'll meet and know the current crop of editors that they have. But at least for now, they're all new faces who we don't know.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Well, all the more faces to meet and schmooze and look forward to seeing them.
Absolutely.
Yep. Shows. Yeah. That was a shocker. Although maybe not so much to some others, but I had no idea that was going on. But I know I'm a lot closer to Cincinnati than you are, but I saw that, like, things are opening up with the Lost Art Press shop or bookstore or
yeah. What is going on in that space? Is it a bookstore? What's he do in that space?
Yes, I haven't read into it too much, but from what I understand, there is a teaching capacity of some sort there, but also the publications that Lost Art Press has are available there. It's an old bar, or at one time was a bar that they moved into. So they, I know they've held, like, you know,
there was stuff at WIA there, wasn't there? A couple
years
ago?
Yeah, they had, it was 2 years ago. Yeah. They had a thing that sold out quickly, obviously, you know, with that crowd, but, where they, they had people over to, and that was when I don't even know if it was officially open at that point, but at this point, I'm seeing, like, you know, hey, we're going to have our store open on Saturday and we're going to be selling this. And so it's kind of like, I don't know, you know, Chris had long talked about, moving away from his basement, you know, as his working space in his home. But that being said, there's also another, like, he's got some garage he's working on. I don't know, but yeah, that's, but I know Megan's, I think she's set up to teach things there. That's why I bring that up, like, mm-hmm. in the future. So, it's as close as 3.5 hours is from my house to there. It would be great to just, like, run down there, but not always, opportune. But at some point I want to,
one day thing.
At some point I want to. Absolutely.
Well, definitely say hi.
I will. I will extend all the love that I can carry along with me. But anyway, so let's get back into to Gary. So, Gary, you have a I mentioned in the intro, you know, the classic book that I think are on most people's shelves, or at least they've seen it on bookshelves, or of the Illustrated Guide to Joinery. But you've got a new book.
Yeah, got a new book out called Handmade, Creative Focus in the Age of Distraction, the long title. But it's a different kind of book. it's not about woodworking per se. It's about working with your hands. And that is a little different. Yeah, it's about a book of inspiration. Talks a little about creativity and the challenges that everyone faces at the bench. New to something.
Let me ask you about being at the bench. I think we're all people who certainly need to get behind the bench to kind of clear our heads and need to make something. Do you think that that's true of everyone, or is it just true of some people that they need that time to physically create?
Oh, I think it's true of everyone.
Okay.
I think it's absolutely true of everyone. I mean, one of the things that I see at my school, at the Northwest Woodworking Studio, is how many tech guys come to take classes because they don't have an opportunity in their day-to-day work. Mm-hmm. To see progress, to see something get built.
Okay.
They're busy, writing code or whatever they're doing. But they don't see the fruits of their labor at the end of the day.
Yeah, that was something I learned growing up. My dad had a 100-year-old colonial, and we did lots and lots of work renovating the entire house. That's one of the reasons I got doors for Christmas one year. and what we would do at the end of every day, the last thing we would do is walk out to a point where we could turn around and look back on what we had done the day, so that right. you could see the tangible things that you did. It's not just, yeah. the you have three pages of work instead of two.
And I think that's really important for people. I think it gives you a sense of accomplishment, and on rare days, perhaps a sense of defeat and that things haven't gone as well as you'd hope. But I think it's just really important for us as humans to put our hands on tools. I think it's helped us in a way to develop our brains, a million years ago. But that grip that we carry in our hands is a pretty amazing thing. And you can do stuff with that grip. And you can do amazing stuff with that grip as if you practice with it. You practice your craft, whatever that craft may be. And so those are some of the topics that I talk about in the book, is the value of practice and the value of failure. That's a big one. And it's an important one. You just have to learn to fail gracefully and pick yourself up and figure out what went wrong and do it again. And that can be challenging some days. I know for myself it can be. So, I think that's an important thing for everyone to be aware of at the bench. The importance of failure.
Speak to the failure for a minute. Do you think that can you succeed without some amount of failure in the past? Do you need the failure to move on?
I think it's imperative. I think it's absolutely imperative. It makes you adjust yourself. I mean, whether it's standing at the bench, I know if I haven't, let's go back to dovetails. I haven't cut dovetails in a month. I'm going to cut some dovetails. Well, I go to the bench. I know how to cut dovetails, but the first set don't feel right. And I'm trying to figure out how to hold myself. These are little tiny failures. These are little things. And you say, oh, I got to adjust here. Oh yeah. I remember I stand like this. And so the learning curve is there, but it's a pretty quick learning curve because I've done it enough times. And I think those little things, it's just like playing baseball or playing an instrument. You go, oh yeah, well, I got to, my embouchure's got to be a little tighter here when I'm playing the trumpet. I used to play the trumpet. Mm-hmm. Or I got to throw the baseball, got to follow through. Where's that ball going? Got to point my hand. And so those little things you're reminding yourself of. Same thing is true at the bench. And so those help inform how you're holding yourself physically and then help you as you're building stuff. I get back to this flow idea where if you've got some time at the bench and develop habits, develop ways that you cut a dovetail joint, develop ways that you cut a Morrison tenon, develop ways that you sharpen, then that flow happens much more easily. And that just makes the process better, makes you happier, and the work comes out a little bit better. But it takes several times to learn, if the nut comes off the Tormac, I'm going to have problems. So let's get that fixed. That's a failure, but you're going to figure it out, right? You're going to get it.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, that's been said, time and time again, that what makes a professional or a master what they are is not so much that they don't make mistakes, is that they know how to deal with them. And that's learning from them. I mean, that's the basis of that.
Well, I think anyone can. It's just a question of, this is a very important topic in my book, forgiveness. Can you forgive yourself for being a knucklehead? You're going to be a knucklehead. That's a given. That is a given. And I know early on in my basement shop, I had a terrible time forgiving myself. I just had to be perfect. And I wasn't. And I proved that to myself. It seemed like every single day, not perfect. And geez, that's tough. It's a tough burden. And it took me years. It took me decades to learn to let go of perfection. And that's a huge one. And if you can forgive yourself, then you can say, oh, you know what? I'm going to quit beating myself up. I'm just going to fix this.
Right.
It usually takes you longer to come to that conclusion that, oh, yeah, I've got to replace this part. The argument takes longer than the actual work. So, you know, that's what I find. It's just shut up, go and do it. It'll be easy. So.
How much of that is kind of leveling with yourself, you know, what it means to be okay or perfection? So I have this ongoing debate with my dad about details, where he goes, you know, he's built a deck, although it's still not finished years later, because he's getting down to the nitty gritty trim stuff. And he goes, oh man, if it's not within a 64th of an inch, it's not accurate. And I'm like, it's outdoors. It's going to move. It's going to swell. It's going to shrink. And in the grand scheme of things, if I'm 10 feet away from it, I'm never going to see that.
Yeah.
And that's easy for me to say, because I'm not doing that work. Because when I went and I trimmed the windows in my boy's room, the minuscule little crack in the miter stands out like a sore thumb to me. And my wife walks in and goes, oh my God, that looks so good.
Yeah.
You know? So, and it's important, I think, to find that middle ground.
Well,
go ahead.
Yeah. The issue is, every project has a different middle ground. You know, building a deck is good work, but it can be done.
Absolutely.
Without worrying about 64ths. And no one's going to notice. And you're not doing a disservice to anyone, unfortunately, but to yourself, to try and be that perfect.
Mm-hmm.
And that's, you know, letting go, that's really hard. And so building these pine sawhorses, you know, I'm looking at it and I'm fussing with them and I'm measuring. And, you know, yeah, well, that's within a 64th. That's a 32nd. Yeah. And then I went, no, these sawhorses. So I'm going to let it go. I'm going to do a good job. No one's going to notice. And I'm not going to notice down the road. That's the thing I think that becomes really important. Get your dad to finish that deck and then build you a deck. He's not going to be looking at 64ths on that second deck. Yeah. He's going to be going for it. And same with you and your miters. You know, you got another house to do. You're not going to be messing around with a little gap. You get some putty, you fill it in, you go, because it's trim.
Right.
Now, that's on the front of your great china cabinet. That's a different story. Mm-hmm. But, you know, focus can change, and it depends on the piece. I think it depends entirely on the piece.
Is that something that one of the benefits of experience is understanding where it matters and where it doesn't, and knowing where you have to go crazy being dead on accurate and where that 64th of an inch is absolutely irrelevant?
Well, I think it depends on whether you're trying to make money or not. And it's true. There would be times when I'd be working on a piece and I would be fussing with something, and I would say to myself, you know, you're not getting paid for this. And myself would answer, yeah, I know, shut up. It wasn't quite as loud as that, but if I needed to do that work, I had to realize that I wasn't going to get paid for it. And sometimes the decision was, I need to do this. It needs to be perfect. I need to have it walk out my door or go out my door being perfect. And I'm not going to get paid for it. And I have to be okay with that. And there are other times when I said, no, I got to get this out the door. So, you know, it just depends on how you have to approach the work. I mean, if you're approaching it as a, as therapy, purely as therapy, you know, a lot of folks just use hand tools. There's no festool sander in there. There's just, you know, everything's going to be done with a hand tool because there's not going to be any noise. You're not creating any dust. That's a choice. It takes much longer, but it's a choice. So there are so many variables.
Right.
I think it's incredibly important, and something I struggle with all the same is finding that, you know, it's, you know, depending on the piece, what does it take to be right, to be settled in? And I am guilty as all get out of, you know, actually, you know, I had my wife ask me over Christmas, you know, when we were meeting with relatives, hey, is that thing done yet? Well, no, because and it's just an excuse that it's like, no, I haven't quite done it right yet. I need to fix that one thing and then I'll get it out, you know, and it's a struggle. And I can look over and I've got like three unfinished projects over, you know, and yeah, well, I don't do much.
I got three unfinished projects started today.
Oh, well,
yeah,
no, well, some of mine are started 3 years ago, so they're long unfinished. Oh, look, I found a fourth. It's interesting that, you know, well, it's a good topic. And I think it's something that a lot of people could learn from, you know, what it again takes to find that middle ground where you can just kind of push through and do good enough without making that sound cheap.
Well, I regularly sign my book with my name and I say, do good work. And I think you can do good work. It doesn't have to be perfect work. Mm-hmm. There's a difference between perfection and excellence. And understanding that difference goes a long way to keeping you sane and enjoying the work instead of hating it and, you know, just, you know, grinding your teeth because it's not perfect. And I was that person. When I did a piece, everything was sanded to perfection, including the backs of the drawers. It was insane, but everything had to be perfect going out of my shop. And then I'd load it into my car and ding it, right? Or into the truck, and I'd ding it and I'd go nuts. And learning to let go of that a little bit. I mean, I'm not saying anything is sloppy. It's not something that anyone's going to notice but me. Right. But letting go of that need for perfection has been huge. And so the insides of all my cabinets, I don't do much plywood work now. But the insides of all my cabinets, since they're solid wood, it's a hand plane surface. That's it. Is there a tear out? As long as it's not nasty, you're not going to cut yourself on it, I leave it. I don't care. It's the inside of the piece and I'm happy doing it. And I tell my students, that's just fine. Just hand plane the inside of it. You're done. You don't have to sand it. It doesn't need to be sanded. You're not going to notice it in 10 years that it was or wasn't sanded. Right. That's the thing that I learned over time. And what's so important, I think, is building a lot of stuff and then coming back and looking at it. And what do you notice? And what do you not even look at? The thing that was keeping you up at night, you know, oh, yeah, I had some splotch in the finish. I don't even notice it now. Look at antiques. There's so much to learn from them. And what's valuable? Go to your museum, wherever your museum is, closest one, and look at the furniture that's there and what is valued and what isn't. And perfection isn't valued.
No.
Mm-hmm. Not a bit. These things, you go to an antique shop and you see these cabinets and you're going, you're getting how much for this thing that's rocking back and forth? Are you kidding me? Mm-hmm. I can build better than that. And you know you could build a better piece than that, but it's got provenance or it's, you know, some famous maker or something, and it's falling apart, but people don't care. So, you know, why are you doing the work? Are you doing it to be perfect? That sets up certain expectations for yourself, you know?
Yeah.
And then you're working in wood. It's not metal. It's wood. And it's alive. It keeps moving on you. So anyway, that's the big thing for me. And so the book is memoirable in that respect. Because I was a perfectionist and it was killing me.
Well, you make a really good point of coming back to a piece years later and paying attention to what you notice and what you don't and trying to, you know, turn that into what's important and what's not. But does teaching also teach you as the teacher some of that perspective? Because you have to think about it differently and articulate it differently to instruct the students rather than just make it yourself?
Well, yes and no. There's the student's perspective is different. And as time recedes for me, you know, it was a long time ago that I started. So I remember how it felt, but you know, I'm sort of straddling both sides of that fence. Yes, I understand you have very high standards. I'm talking to the student. You have very high standards, and your work is nowhere close to where you want it to be. Mm-hmm. High standards, work sucks. What do you do? Well, you got to keep practicing, and that's really what it comes down to. But it's there's some learning that always has to go on.
How long have you been teaching? To you know, and has that progressed, or has that changed your outlook on that? Oh, across the years.
Well, I started teaching. Just 6-8 years after I started, just to bring in some cash, just to bring in some dough. I would teach, an evening class, once a term at a community center, drop-in center down in the, just call it the Bowery District of Portland. I took on some strange jobs, just sort of get out and not be alone in my shop all day. That was important, but also to teach and just kind of share some of this information. And yes, it's changed a lot over the years. So I started teaching in 1980. So it's my skills as a teacher are so different now. And it's so much to learn about teaching that has nothing to do with woodworking. Which is why I love going to take classes from other people. It doesn't have to be woodworking. It can be in any discipline. I did a class in tying bamboo. It was so instructive. I have to tell you this story. So we have this incredible Japanese garden in Portland. And if you're ever here, you got to go to the Japanese garden and check it out. And there's work done there by a temple carpenter, Dale Brotherton, who's up in Seattle. He does amazing work. Anyway, gorgeous stuff. So they have this class in tying bamboo, and there's a special 6-bite knot to tie this bamboo correctly, and I couldn't get it. And we had 3 different teachers, and they each had a different method for tying this knot. It's tricky, and I would get it, and then I'd forget, and then I'd get it, and then I'd forget. And the last teacher of the day came up to me, and he said, "Okay, you're having trouble with this. Do you know how to fish?" I go, "No." He says, "It's just like fishing." kind of left me in the lurch there. But I learned how not to use analogies like that, because everyone's got a different approach and you got to help them get through. And people have different needs. So Tom has to watch me do things. Other people, you tell them what to do and they're off. Other people, you hand them read this, and that's how they learn.
Right.
So everyone's got, and that's, that's really important. Because you're a good woodworker doesn't mean you're a good teacher. Because you're a good musician, same thing is true.
Yeah, teaching and any skill are different things.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's, so that's really important. And so I've learned a lot about that over the years, and it's, I was always going to be a teacher. I just happened to be a woodworker along the way.
Do you do more these days? Is it more teaching or is it more building?
No, it's been more teaching for the last 10 years. I moved into a new building, 100-year-old building, new building for me, 11 years ago. And I've been working hard on the mastery program, and we started a nonprofit a few years ago to mentor high school kids.
Okay.
And still trying to jump through the hurdles to work with veterans, and that's very frustrating. But there's real need out there in the community for these sorts of skills to be disseminated, not for job training. I'm not job training when I teach the high school kids. It's just, that is not what I do. I'm teaching them how to think.
Right.
That's so different than showing them how to run a CNC. I don't care about CNCs. I want people to learn how to problem solve. And that can help them in any situation. And that's what I can do for folks. So. So I'm focusing on the teaching, and it's been great.
Excellent. And I'm assuming, it's kind of mentioned before, but yeah, you continue to learn as you teach.
Oh, yeah, there's always stuff to learn. It's sometimes it's about the craft. More often it's about psychology. It's about how to handle situations and how to help people succeed. And how to help people, you know, this idea of forgiveness occurred. We do these, there's no better word for it, Chautauquas. We do these talks, usually during the winter months, once a month. And I choose a big ticket item like creativity and get a couple of people to come up with me. And we sit and the three of us talk about creativity. We talked about curiosity. We talked about quality. So these are really fascinating topics, and there are no right answers, and we're just out talking about stuff. And I had a pianist in, Bill Crane, and my friend David Minnick, who shot the cover photo, and held 2/3 of the Complete Illustrated Guidebook. He shot for me as well. And so he was talking about it from a photographic point of view, about curiosity, and Bill was talking about it as a musician. And I started to talk about it, and I looked I had two residents that year, and I looked over at one of them, at Patrick, and I realized, and this is a guy who came from 20-some years in the military, and wanted to set up a shop, but was struggling a little bit, and I just started, this idea of forgiveness came to my mind, and I was just looking right at him, like, going, you got to forgive yourself. You're going to make mistakes. You got to let that go and learn from it and move on. And I had never thought about that before. So that's, you know, things that pop up in the middle of trying to help someone. And that makes it pretty satisfying.
So is the new book, and I'm scrolling through the show notes to get the name right. The new book of Handmade, Creative Focus in the Age of Distraction. Is that a result of philosophy you have come to after years of doing this and teaching this?
A little bit. A lot of stories in there. I've told to my master's students so many times. I said, I should put these down. But then I reread Zen and the Art of Motorcycle Maintenance.
Mm-hmm.
And I read it back in college, and it was a completely different book to me. I read it something like 5 or 6 years ago, and then read it again. And there was so much to get from that. And I was in such a different position in my life, having done work with my hands, that I thought that there was a. I always thought there was another book to write, and this is how it came out. So, and that was great fun. That was great fun because it ties together so many different ideas about quality, which is what Persig was talking about in Zen and the Art of Motorcycle Maintenance, but also what Betty Edwards is talking about in Drawing on the Right Side of the Brain. You guys know that book?
No.
Great book. Great book. Basically, this book came out 30 years ago, and, you know, most of us stopped learning how to draw in the 4th grade, you know, or 5th grade. And we switched over to drawing symbols. Oh, this is what a house looks like. No, there's not that little curlicue of smoke coming out of it. There's light and shadow, and there's proportion. And so it's a great book to teach people not how to draw, but how to see. And that's her whole approach, is how to see and how to shut off your left brain and utilize your right brain, because she's a believer in the system that there's two hemispheres. They work together, of course, but the right brain is the creative side and the left brain is the logical side. And as woodworkers, that's the side we use 90% of the time. And we really need it so to keep our fingers out of the blade. Very important. But when you're designing, it's the right side of the brain that you need to be utilizing. It's that creative side, the synthetic side that's just getting ideas from all sorts of places. And it's the side that's inventive. It comes up with stuff. And that's what's so cool. And that's the same idea that Persig was talking about in Zen and the Art of Motorcycle Maintenance, because he was talking about this divide between Aristotle and Plato. And this, so Aristotle had this idea about classification. So a motorcycle is made up of the ignition system and the suspension system and braking system and all these different systems. Mm-hmm. And Plato is sitting there on the motorcycle revving it up, and he takes off and his hair is flying back going, man, this is great. So the difference is really astonishing between those two schools of thought. And quality comes when you can merge the two together, when you can bring that analytic side together with that synthetic side and create work that's well made, that's also beautiful.
It's balance between form and function.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. That's it. So, what was the question?
No questions. Only answers.
Yeah. Yeah.
Excuse me. It's all very good. No, pardon you. I've never actually heard it, you know, quite stated the way you just did. So that's but yeah, I mean, Diami kind of hit it. It's form over function. I mean, it kind of simplifies it a little bit, but very interesting.
But I think it's a universal approach, but not approach. It's an approach that a lot of people. It's a universal approach for experienced craftspeople, I think, is the way I would phrase it. It's something that when you're learning a craft, you need to learn that balance.
Mm-hmm. I think so.
Yeah, the problem with craft, and there's an excellent book I read after I got this book published by Richard Sennett called The Craftsman.
Mm-hmm.
It's what I call a very chewy book. So it's pretty heady stuff. But, you know, he's talking about the need for craftspeople always throughout time to continue to improve their craft, to get better at it, to always be, you know, be self-critical and, you know, try and do a really good job, and which automatically slows you down and automatically make sure that you're not going to make money. And then he referenced Plato again, saying, you know, we should call these guys poets because these craftspeople are creating poetry. And then, you know, that didn't happen because no one has valued in the history of civilization has valued crafts very highly. It's all, you know, it's a little bit better than menial labor, but it's not really fine art, you know. The applied arts section in the museum is usually hidden away. Mm. And that's just the way it is. And if you come to recognize that, then you say, oh, it's not me. And it's not my time. It's never been valued. It's just human nature. So I've got to satisfy myself. I've got to satisfy my urges. And to hell with everyone else. You know, if I'm going to make money on it, great. If I'm not, I'm going to get by. You know, if you can work with your hands, you're going to get by. But you're never going to get rich. And that's great. That's fine. As I tell my students, it's a terrible way to make a living. It's a great way to live.
Yeah.
So what do you want to do? I just think it's, you know, we get wrapped up in perfection and trying to make these perfect joints or perfect jigs or, you know, and all we're trying to do is get to the bench and take care of ourselves, you know, just chill for a while and build something. And it's gravy. I wish I could just give all the stuff away that it would be so much easier. Just here, take this. I don't have to worry about money here. Just take this. And not have to worry about, did I hit my mark? Did I make my money?
Just build it for the sake of building it.
Yeah, because, you know, every piece I've ever built, and I know this is true, although it may have been delivered to a client's house, it's still my piece.
Right.
I still feel like it's my piece. They may have it, but it's still mine. And so that connection is always there. And it what happens after you finish a project? Usually what happens to us after we finish a project is, boy, if I could build that, you think to yourself, if I could build that again, I'd really nail it this time. Because look how much I learned. Right? Yeah. Doesn't that happen? Mm-hmm. It happens all the time. And so, you know, it's that process and all the stuff that's going on in your head while you're building, that's so valuable. So anyway, it's good stuff. I'm lucky. I've been at the workbench now 40 some years. I'm a lucky guy. So I wrote about it. I got nothing to do, you know.
Nothing wrong with that.
No, I'm envious of it.
No, indeed.
But I think that's a good point to touch off on, because I think that sums up. I think it sums up a philosophy, but hopefully it also sums up the book. But Sean, you want to move on to the next section?
You mean the fortnightly beer choice?
I think that'd be a wonderful section to move on to.
Well, that sounds like a great section to move on to. I pulled into my very shallow cellar this evening to pull off the shelves my Founders KBS that I got last year. So it's been aging a year.
How is it?
It's fantastic. For those not aware, it is a chocolate coffee stout aged in oak bourbon barrels.
Wow. Plus the KBS is Kentucky Breakfast Stout, right?
It's Kentucky Breakfast Stout, yes. Made by Founders, limited release every year they do it. This is last year's that I got my hands on. I didn't even get this year's, so I kind of wanted to hold it a little longer so I could have them together, but whatever. But yeah, it is it's amazing. And when brewed, it comes in just shy of 12%. So it's a heady little brew.
Good Lord.
But it is it's very well balanced, very very rich. I guess without being overtaking in that way, but that was nice. And it took me about an hour to finish, which is a good sign of a heavy a heavy beer. Diami, how about Excellent. You?
Well, I have the 6-point Hootie Hoo, which
Hootie
is Hootie Hoo. It's the companion beer to their Hootie. The Hootie being an unfiltered New England IPA. The Hootie Hoo is an unfiltered hazy American pale ale. It's delightful. It is it's a good American ale, and it's a little on the hoppy side. I think that's the new brewmaster that 6-point has.
Extra hoppy for 6-point, because everything I know of them is hoppy.
I don't share that opinion of 6-point. Most of their beers are hoppy style beers, but their non hoppy style beers are not hoppy. So I would say that they lean towards hoppy styles, but they're not necessarily a hoppy brewery. Like they have a Kolsch.
Mm-hmm.
That is not particularly hoppy. It tastes like a Kolsch. It's a variant of lager. This is a bit hoppy. It's incredibly hazy. It's got an orangey hue to it, and I'm pretty sure that's because of the hops that are in it. It's well worth getting, but unfortunately, you can't get it. this was 6-point has started a program of incredibly limited releases, and I've missed the first couple because for the first couple, you had to be at their brewery in Brooklyn at 9 a.m. on a Saturday morning to get them. And they've just begun that on the limited releases, you can go on Saturday, Monday, or Tuesday. So I was able to go on a Monday and pick this up. But this is 6-point has their own app. And when they have these limited releases, they'll go on sale on like a Thursday at noon, and you buy them through the app and you reserve them. And once they're gone and that's it. They don't make any more.
That's an interesting way of doing that.
It is. And I think it's personally, I think it's better than a lot of the breweries that do the limited releases where you have to wait online and then you're online and you don't get them. In this case, you go on the app and they're there or they're not, and you reserve them and then you go and you pick them up.
Mm-hmm.
And the fact that they're now, you don't have to pick them up on a Saturday morning anymore. You go during the week, I think makes it much, much more achievable. So this is the first of the really limited releases that I was able to get. Cause again, I was able to pick them up on a Monday. And it's very, very good. I was not disappointed. It was worth the drive to Brooklyn.
Yeah. You were spoiling my idea of saying, oh, I need to look for that, because most of the 6-point I've had is I think resin and maybe another one that's...
Yeah, well, resin is a double IPA. That is certainly hoppy.
Very, very hoppy. But no, interesting. I'm glad to hear that they're branched out, you know, from, I guess, what I get here, which isn't saying much because we're not exactly in their area. But good stuff. Gary, how about you? If you're familiar with the show, this is a common thing we do. You have a drink of choice. It doesn't have to be alcoholic, even.
Oh well, I've been known to tip back a few.
All right,
and I found a new beer. I'm trying to get to their website now. Called Frem, Frim beer. Frem beer. They're out of Hood River, and I'm not a hoppy guy, so I love a good Pilsner, and that's what they have. They have a Pilsner, and, you know, Pilsners can be, you know, sort of anywhere from a Budweiser to, you know, a Pilsner Urquell, which I like, but this beer was really good. It had some liveliness to it that you don't really get in a Pilsner. So I don't know if it goes back east or not, or whether it's just out here out west.
I'm not sure. I'm just looking on their website.
Yeah.
That's definitely one I've never heard of.
Yeah. I think it's a relatively new brewery. I don't know of a town that doesn't claim, or a state that doesn't claim, it has the most breweries now in the country. but Oregon.
Oh, no. I think Oregon's right up there.
We have a lot of breweries.
That one's definitely out there. And if it's not true, it should be. And I will say, and I'm in Ohio, and Ohio has a fair amount of breweries.
Yeah.
We're a big state relatively. But there's a handful, but I hear about more and more from the Portland or just Oregon area.
Mm. Yeah. There's a bunch.
It's a bunch, and they're known for their beer culture, which is, beneficial to the brewers, you know, up and coming.
I think it may have hit peak, but I know that Vermont claims to have the most per capita, and I'm assuming that there's more people in Oregon than there are in Vermont, because not that many people live in Vermont.
Right. I think the population of Vermont fits in my county.
Yeah, I actually got a T-shirt for Christmas that I don't know when the shirt was printed, but at the time it was printed, it had every brewery in Vermont spelled out in the shape of Vermont.
Oh wow!
But in any event, no. But the proliferation, proliferation. Thank you. It's late. The proliferation of local breweries everywhere, frankly, has been amazing over the last 5 to 10 years. But I think in Portland and the surrounding area, you're really lucking out in the availability of everything out there.
Yeah, we've got a pretty wide selection. And it's not just beer or wine. I mean, wine was first out here.
Mm-hmm.
And then beer showed up. And now, I mean, where the studio is, you can't throw a rock without hitting a brewery. Hmm. It's pretty, pretty true. Or a distillery. I mean, they're all over the place, so... There you go.
All right.
That's not bad. Well, with that, that just about wraps us up for this show. If you haven't already, please subscribe to the show on iTunes or Google Play Music. Just search for the Modern Woodworkers Association. Then you'll be sure to never miss any of our new exciting episodes. When you're there, please leave us a review.
Thank you for listening to the Modern Woodworkers Association. If you like the show, be sure to visit modernwoodworkersassociation.com. You can follow the MWA on Twitter at MWA_national. You can like the MWA on Facebook, or you could just tell a friend, because word of mouth is the best way to spread the discussion.
And so with that, I am Sean Wisniewski of The Corner Workshop. I'm at SeanW78 on most social medias, including Untappd, where I checked in my KBS tonight. And just search for my name on Facebook.
And while I can be found at Penultimate Woodshop, at Diami Plotki on the Twitter, or at Modern Woodworkers Association, most importantly, Gary, where can people find you online?
Well, the studio, Northwest Woodworking Studio, is at northwestwoodworking.com, all spelled out. That's northwestwoodworking.com. And I'm on Twitter at Gary Rogowski. And Facebook is Northwest Woodworking. And yeah, then we're stretching the limits of my knowledge. We're on Instagram too, but I can't keep up. But yeah, we're in all those spots. So
look for Northwest Woodworking Studio.
Northwestwoodworking.com is our website.
Okay, so, and where is the best place for people to buy the book?
The best place is at woodworkerslibrary.com. That's Linden Publishing. That's who published the book. So it's called Woodworkers Library, and they've got it. They're giving the book away just about. They're beating Amazon's price. So, yeah, that's a great place to pick up the book. So, thanks very much, guys, for having me on. I really
no problem. It's been a pleasure.
Yeah, it was fun to chat. Very well. It's early. It's time for dinner for me, not for you guys.
Oh, probably, must be nice.
Time for a beer for you guys. Bedtime.
Bed.
Yeah.
Right. Absolutely. So with that, everybody, go out in your shop, pour some epoxy, wait a week for it to dry, and then have fun sanding.